Well, I think we'll get started. Take your seats. Well, let me first of all say good morning and happy holidays to everyone. I think the House, I think it's going to adjourn today, isn't it, for the holidays? So, anyways, we're in that season. First of all, let me introduce myself. I'm Pat Leahy. I'm the Executive Director of the American Geosciences Institute, which is located just across the river in Alexandria, Virginia. Let me turn this on.
It's on.
Okay. It doesn't have a light. So I want to thank everyone for coming today and fitting it into your busy schedules. And certainly on behalf of the American Geosciences Institute, or AGI as we like to call it, I'm pleased to be here this morning, and I think this is a terribly important briefing. It's entitled Critical Minerals, Ensuring America's Future. And frankly, there's an old saying that I'm sure everyone in this room has heard, is that you can't grow it, you have to mine it. You know, that's where things come from. Unfortunately, we forget that. I want to thank Congressman Rush Holt, New Jersey 12th District, for sponsoring today's briefing and for his support in doing that. And in addition to my own organization, I want to thank the other hosts for the briefing here today, the other sponsors, and they are the Geological Society of America, the Environmental and Energy Study Institute, the National Mining Association, and the Society for Mining, Metallurgy, and Exploration. Some fine organizations. As I mentioned, minerals and products made from minerals are all around us. It's hard to look around the room and not find something made out of minerals. Maybe the only thing in this room is podium is not, and some paper. But I'm sure there are minerals involved in the production of those products. I used to lament when I was with USGS, I had responsibility for both the minerals program and for the energy program. And energy used to get a lot of play, and I always said it's because the general populace knew what a gas pump looked like. And if only there were a cadmium pump somewhere that people had to go to, there would be a greater appreciation for the importance of minerals in their everyday life. So, you know, we consume a lot here in the U.S. Every year, about 25,000 pounds of new non-fuel minerals are extracted from the earth for each person in the country. Well, some have been in the press, and they all seem to get their moment in the limelight. Right now, rare earths and other critical mineral resources have become essential to daily life, and as we excel in the 21st century, we're finding more varied uses of these perhaps not so rare earths elements in terms of what we need. And it's hard to find an individual that does not have a cell phone today, and that technology certainly wouldn't have been possible without some of these. So it's a lot of minerals that are in the press are really the building blocks of modern civilization. Now, many of you have seen, and I suspect in the briefing today, you'll see a chart that shows the dependence on foreign countries for various commodities. There was a lot of press about China in terms of rare earths needed for both military fiber optic application. There is no question that world population continues to grow, as well as the standard of living for most of the developing world. And frankly, that standard of living is an important thing, but all this means is that there will be an increasing demand for mineral supplies for the future. There's no question that supply disruptions get people very upset, and this leads to international conflict, which I think everyone would like to see humanity avoid. Let me say a little bit about AGI before I introduce the first speaker here. We provide basically service to and serve as the voice of the geoscience profession here in the U.S. and globally, for that matter. AGI is an umbrella organization. We do not have individual memberships. We have organizations that are members, and we have 50 of those societies. Frankly, I guess the geoscience community is a group that likes to split up. They don't like to conform. So that's a result of that. But if you take all those members and cull out the ones that perhaps belong to multiple organizations, we come up with about representing about 250,000 geoscientists in the United States. And as best as we can estimate, that's pretty much everybody. We may be missing a few here and there, but they'd be darn few. But we feel that puts us in a very unique position in terms of looking at that whole geoscience landscape, everything from pipeline issues in terms of the profession, how we're educating people, are we educating enough, will there be enough geoscientists for the future, will they be the right kind, will they have the right training, two things that are happening here on the Hill, and this briefing is one of those things. Well, today, let's get on to the meat of the matter. We have three distinguished speakers who will discuss the critical need for mineral resources and the role of the USGS and its partners in working to assess the availability of mineral resources. There's a lot of time scheduled afterwards for questions and answers, and I hope you'll prevail yourself with that. So I would ask people to hold their questions to the end. Let me introduce our first speaker, Jonathan Price. John is a consulting geologist and is the emeritus Nevada State geologist. His experience includes educating undergraduate and graduate geology students, working in mining and exploration, and in government. His current focus is on evaluating opportunities in copper, zinc, gold, and other ores for byproduct production of critical elements, particularly those needed for emerging technologies. He served as president of numerous professional societies and has received many awards, including the American Geosciences Institute's Ian Campbell Award for superlative services to the geosciences. And John will be discussing the growing need for minerals that many people have never heard of and the demand for information about them. The fact that they haven't heard about them, to me, is one of the challenges we face as a profession. So, John.
Thank you, Pat. What I'd like to do is cover three main points. The first is that the demand for mineral resources is at an all-time high and is likely to continue to grow over time. The second is that we're not likely to run out of mineral resources on a global basis. And the third is that there are still a number of challenges, particularly for the United States, in the whole business of mineral resources. To illustrate that first point, let me show you this graph of copper. This goes back to 1900. We're looking at copper production in blue. We're looking at world population in green. And then dividing production by world population, essentially a measure of consumption, or another way to look at it is the standard of living. As more and more people in throughout the world get electricity, have refrigerators, drive automobiles, the demand for copper goes up. So what we're seeing here is, although world population has gone up quite a bit in the last 100 years or so, the production of mineral resources, in this case copper, has gone up astronomically. We see much more consumption than we did 100 years ago on a per capita basis, and we see that overall production going up quite a bit, and particularly in the last two decades in the case of copper. Another way of looking at that issue is looking at how the elements are used. This is a series of periodic tables going back to 1932. And you can see back then that our use of the elements on the periodic table was somewhat limited. We had quite a number that were in use. But over time, we got to a point today where essentially everything on the periodic table, with a couple of exceptions of radioactive elements that are basically long gone, we are using everything on the periodic table today. Another way of looking at it, or the second issue, actually, of the fact that we're not likely to run out of mineral resources is illustrated here with gold. We had a peak in gold back with the 49ers in California in the 1850s. That was a pretty minor peak compared to the boom that we're in today. We're in the biggest boom in gold mining history ever, both globally and nationally. I was just at a meeting in Reno on Tuesday where we heard about the discovery and the development of two new gold deposits there that are going to help to continue that trend. We're going to be in this boom of gold mining for at least another 20 or 30 years. This brings us to the challenges that we have for mineral resources. And the one that I'd like to stress probably the most is that China is number one. We've seen this in terms of the copper production. Much of the copper use has gone to China. We see it in a number of other commodities as well. And one way of illustrating it is with this graph, where we have world population in percentages here, and you can see that China has about 19% of the world's population. If everything were equal sort of geographically and geologically, you'd expect China to produce about 19% of the world's mineral resources. But in fact, they produce a whole lot more of many of those resources. Rare earths there at 94% in 2012. Steel is at 48%. China's producing 48% of the world's steel, and the main component going into steel is iron ore. They produce about 42% of the world's iron ore. The fact that they're adding value to materials, making iron ore into steel and selling the steel, making rare earths into magnets and selling the magnets and other products, is also a big challenge for us, as we want to keep a manufacturing capability in the U.S. The rare earths hit the national spotlight a few years ago, and it was illustrated in part by this Dilbert cartoon, where he actually realized that 20% or so of the world's population is in China, and that rare earths are a big deal. The fact that Dilbert is aware of these issues, I think, is showing us that it's gone beyond the geeky scientists concerned about the issue, and that more people are now aware of what's going on. And it's not just rare earths. It's lots of other elements on the periodic table that we're concerned about in terms of criticality. I was involved in a study a couple of years ago about the emerging needs for new technologies in the energy arena, and the fact that a number of elements used in various new energy technologies may be in short supply. That brought a lot of attention to tellurium as one example in solar panels, the rare earths and the magnets that go into wind turbines, lithium and vanadium for batteries. Fuel cells in cars need platinum and palladium, and various rare earths are needed in fluorescent lights as well. Another point to illustrate, though, is that what we consider to be critical is going to change with time. If you go back 300 years ago, probably one of the most critical resources, mineral resources in the U.S. was flint for arrowheads. And we've all heard about peak oil. Well, here's a graph of peak flint production. And clearly, the change in technology has meant a change in the resources. We have plenty of flint and obsidian and other stone tool resources in the U.S., but the demand just isn't there anymore because of the changes in technology. That raises the question of what will the mineral resources be that will be most critical in the future, and we frankly don't know for sure. We can make pretty good projections for the next 20 years or so, but projecting out into the longer future is really pretty much impossible. So we need to be aware of where those mineral resources are throughout the world. I failed to mention earlier that essentially all the slides that I've shown are using data that comes from the U.S. Geological Survey. That's the source of the information that we're using to evaluate what's going on globally and in the U.S. in terms of mineral development. So from my perspective, a big issue is whether or not we, the United States, will be a major producer of mineral resources into the future. I personally believe we need to be to maintain that manufacturing and value-added capability. We need to have access to those mineral resources. And a related sort of question is, will the USGS, the primary source of the information that we have, will the USGS be funded to provide the data and the information, the analysis of that data, and the research support needed on mineral resources for the U.S. economy and the U.S. security? So thank you.
Thank you, John. And like I said, we'll hold questions to the open discussion at the end. And our next speaker is Larry Meyer. Larry is a program coordinator for the USGS Minerals Program, and is the editor-in-chief of the scientific journal Economic Geology. He received many professional awards during his career. The program that Larry leads, you'll be hearing a lot about, but it delivers unbiased science about where mineral commodities are known and suspected in the Earth's crust, about 1 kilometer deep, as I recall, and about the environmental consequences of those commodities. The unique expertise that USGS has developed over decades, and I would say probably from the first day of the survey on, so maybe a century or more, in response to mineral resource-related issues, now supports applications such as public health, research, and remediation of natural hazards. Decision-makers in the public and private sector rely on the USGS for information on mineral resource potential, production, consumption, and how mineral resources interact with the environment. So one way of looking at this is it looks at the entire life cycle associated with minerals. So that's a fairly unique role in government. And again, I'll use an energy analogy. You'd have to go to multiple agencies to get that all of that information together. So I think it's really one-stop shopping that's of extreme value. So Larry, the floor is yours.
Welcome, everyone. John did a great job of giving you the overall view of mineral resources. And the fundamental take-home message is that mineral resources are the building blocks of civilization. I'm now going to focus down a little bit to what the USGS does, both some of our ongoing projects and how things will play out in the future. The reason why most people are in this room is that rare earth elements for the last several years have been in the news. Headlines in the New York Times, John mentioned the Dilbert cartoon. And so this gets subjects of mineral resources that aren't normally part of everyday banter or cocktail conversation into the common parlance. Okay. But this is a long-standing issue, and I don't want to go through the details. We can go all the way back to World War I, World War II, where there were lots of concerns about various strategic and critical minerals, the names for these, the actual minerals have changed through time. The oil embargo of the 1970s brought a lot of this to people's attention when we realized that we weren't an independent player. The United States was not the only thing in the globe that really were interdependent with a lot of other countries, and that affected our everyday well-being. It affected jobs, national security, everything that we do. Okay, the resource wars of the 1980s really was part of the Cold War. We were concerned about the interplay between the Soviet Union and the United States and other countries about the access to resources and whether one side might be controlling or not allowing resource access to other people. This resulted in a variety of studies, many legislative acts, including the National Critical Minerals Act in 1984, and we then segue into the rise of developing economies. You've heard a lot about China and Brazil and Indonesia, countries with large populations, rising standard of living, needs for lots of mineral resources. And so all this has been focused, particularly with the rare earth elements, on what is the situation of the United States? Should we be concerned? What information do we have? And so this is a great question to address. And I'll start with this. Many people have seen this before. This is a compilation of the U.S. dependence upon other countries for different mineral resources. Okay? So up at the top, we've got about 20 minerals for which the U.S. is entirely dependent upon other countries. Okay? So that means we get close to 100% of all of our supplies, all those things up on top. The exact ones are not important. The take-home message from this graph is that we are part of an interdependent world. We depend on the rest of the world. We interact with the rest of the world. And this has always been the case, always will be the case in the future. To illustrate that for a particular commodity, for rare earth elements, again, being the focus of most people's attention, if we look at the last 50 years or so, we went from a position of the United States being the world's dominant supplier of rare earth elements until about 1985. And then, as you can see on the right side of this graph, the contribution from China started off from close to zero, and then very quickly it became majority, and then for the last couple of years, been greater than 90% of the total world supply of rare earth elements. So this is a fundamental shifting dynamic about where production is coming from, and it plays out in terms of access and people's ability to, shall we say, play political games with who has access to resources and who doesn't. Okay, but this is a simple fact that China is producing the vast bulk of the world's rare earth elements right now. And as John mentioned previously, this is also true for a lot of other elements. I would say that not only do we have critical minerals, but the idea that information itself is critical. So we need to know about these minerals. We need some baseline information. Who produces what? Where are future supplies potentially coming from? And as John mentioned, the USGS is the sole federal supplier for this type of information. Not just for the federal government, but for the entire world. I was at a meeting last week with the European Union and Japan, a tripartite commission, and they all depend on the same information that I'm showing here. We have copies of several of these things. Most people are familiar with the one right in the center, the mineral commodity summaries, that every year comes out and gives a snapshot of who produces what, who consumes what, where these things are. And the whole world relies upon that information. In addition to the information about where things are and how much there is, we also do work on analysis of how things move around the globe, what we call materials flow. And so what are these things used for? What is the whole life cycle? All the way from the resource in the ground, the production, the fabrication of things, the recycling, potential recycling, that whole life cycle and how things move around the globe, the idea of supply chains. If it's mined in country A and then goes to country B for smelting and refining, then country C for production and fabrication, and country D for consumption, go down the alphabet, eventually get to recycling, all these things need to be factored in. And what most people don't think about is that those supply chains can be quite vulnerable to disruptions that we don't normally think about. As one example of this, publication on the upper right of the previous diagram is a study that we did very quickly after the major earthquake off in the coast of Japan, resulting in a tsunami. Everyone has heard about this, the major damage to the nuclear power plants. What most people didn't realize is that Japan actually is involved in a lot of different mineral resource activity. And that earthquake and the resulting tsunami resulted in the disruption of a lot of different commodities. Things like iodine, for which Japan supplies 25% of the world's entire production. Okay, other things like titanium. It got a lot of press because titanium is used in car colors, and so there was a period where the Ford Motor Company couldn't produce certain colors of cars because of the slight supply disruption. So when we talk about mineral resources, it's not just where they are and are they adequate, but how they move around the globe and the potential for something, whether it be political unrest, whether it be a natural phenomenon like an earthquake or a hurricane, whether those could disrupt the supply chain. We also look at the availability of resources, not just what we know for sure is in the ground, but trying to estimate what potential resources could be out there for different regions of the world and on a global scale for some commodities. This is usually called resource assessment. And there's several different levels of this, left in the category for inventories. This is describing what's already known at different levels of certainty, from active mines to reserves and resources that are in the ground that potentially could be developed. And over on the right to the idea of assessment. This is looking at regions of either the Earth or a state or the globe and asking the question, how much could potentially be there? And we use a series of reasoning steps geologically to constrain that, to provide estimates for policymakers and other stakeholders to understand what the potential is for different commodities. This is an example of one of the recent assessments we've done. We call this one the Global Copper Assessment. This is the world's first assessment on a total global scale of a major resource like copper. And we did this for a variety of different copper deposits. This is just one example of them for a region in Southeast Asia for porphyry copper deposits, one of the major sources of copper. And we can do that and estimate the likelihood of different levels of copper to be found in the future that could potentially be there in that region. To make those sort of estimates, we use a lot of different data, including geologists walking across the ground with their boots, something geologists love to do, a lot of high-tech things involving modeling and computers, and the very colorful image in the upper right is an image from space looking down at a region, and all those colors correspond to different things that we can remotely sense to try to estimate what minerals might be there. This got a lot of press for an area in another part of the world you've probably heard of, Afghanistan, where we did the world's first hyperspectral study. That's what all those colors represent, different minerals, in an area where, for obvious reasons, due to active conflict, it was difficult to get geologist boots on the ground. There are lots of other boots on the ground there. This was funded by the Afghan government, where they wanted to get a better feel for what resources might be available in the country. When this was published in some of the resulting studies, a major rare earth element deposit was also discovered. It was outlined the possibility in that part of the world. We got a lot of questions about, wow, this is really exciting stuff. We didn't realize you could do this. What is the potential for doing that in the United States? And whenever I'm asked that question, I always ask, I'm glad you asked that question. We would love to be able to do that for the entire United States, but it really comes down to budgets. As I mentioned, this was funded by the Afghan government. And if we had funding to be able to do this level of research for the United States, it would be a wonderful boon to a lot of our understanding of mineral resources. Okay. We are trying to bring some of that technology back to the U.S. on a limited function within the budgets that we have. And this is what I'd like to briefly highlight. This is an area we call the Mid-Continent Rift area of the United States. So we have Minnesota and Michigan up and Wisconsin up on the top, Iowa down below. What we're looking at here is a geophysical image of the subsurface, what's below the ground, below the cornfields, below the glacial deposits. And this is based upon fairly widely spaced data, but it clearly shows this purple thing cutting right through the middle of Minnesota and Iowa that we call the Mid-Continent Rift. This is the extension of a very richly mineralized zone in Canada. Okay? That's a trillion-dollar industry in Canada. We know that same belt of rocks extends down the subsurface, and so we'd like to be able to characterize what that looks like. So using the same type of geophysical techniques that we've developed in other countries, we've looked at a very small part of this to try to demonstrate what could be found. And the way we do that is flying geophysical instruments, and these things look pretty exotic, so this is a helicopter flying one of these surveys. And when we do these, we work very closely with the state geological surveys, with local communities. Could you imagine, when this helicopter dragging this flies over somebody's house, they tend to get excited and call 911 and say, "What was that?" So they say, "Well, calm down. That's just the United States Geological Survey doing good, solid research like they should be doing." They don't quite say it that way, but they should. So this is an illustration of what came out of it. On the left is the old data that we had. And it's very smooth over. There's just a few data points there. And on the right is the new airborne, what we call vertical gradient gravity, that shows a much more detailed picture. You see that little circular area? We actually were able to confirm the existence of meteorite impact in the subsurface of Iowa that was suspected but never really had clear evidence. But we can actually image that circle very, very clearly. So this is a meteorite that hit the Earth more than 400 million years ago. And we now know it's there using this sort of technology. It makes one sort of tremble with excitement if you're a geologist about what we could possibly do with the rest of the country if we had the ability to do that everywhere. Okay, some other new techniques we're developing. We've developed a new analytical technique to analyze on a bulk scale very quickly and very low cost the entire periodic table. And the reason we developed this technique was to answer the simple question. We've had centuries of mining in the United States and certainly in other parts of the world that were mined for X, for gold or for copper. And almost every one of those resources was analyzed for that element that they were mining, but not for other elements, either because people didn't know about it or incident, or more likely, they didn't have the analytical techniques to do it. So we asked the question, for example, for rare earth elements, what is the possibility that some of these things that were mined for gold or for copper, and there's large waste piles or tailings piles of the waste material, what is the possibility of there being rare earth elements, or platinum, or copper, in those that no one ever analyzed before? So we developed this technique. We've been applying it. This is the beginning of a pilot project to a variety of different samples of rocks and tailings and waste from different things. And we found some very amazing things. Some of these rocks contain ore-grade levels of rare earth elements that nobody even knew about before. That's different than saying it's an economic deposit. We don't know that, but we're doing the fundamental research to try to allow people to see possibilities. And one last thing I'll cover is another project that we're just starting to roll out that has tremendous potential for reshaping our understanding of the United States. This is a soil map of the entire nation, and the sample density on the scale of the entire country is quite large. You can see on the left, it looks like measles has taken over the United States. And so those are the samples. There's more than 4,000 individual sites. For each one of those sites, a sample was taken right at the surface, sort of halfway through the soil profile, and then right down near the bedrock. So it's the underlying geology. And I'll show you just one example of that. We've done this for the entire periodic table, a variety of pathogens, so the data set is just huge. This is just looking at lead. And so this map is showing us the distribution of lead right down near the bedrock. So this is the geological stuff down below, not yet the influence of people, which I'll show you in the next slide. And you can see there's quite a variation across the United States. And probably everybody in this room either lives or was born somewhere on this map. And I'm sure your eyes going right to where you live or grew up and went, whoa, what's going on there? There's either a bright red or a bright blue spot where I live. Why is that there versus somewhere else? Okay, the next map is the same thing, the same samples, except now right up near the surface. So we are looking at the effect of humans. And you can see there's a vastly different pattern here. And you can see that red, which is the very highest levels of lead, is concentrated in the northeast, very high population densities, and very high transportation. This is basically looking at the effect of leaded gasoline over decades. None of this is a surprise. We knew these sort of things were there, but this allows us to image them. So we have, again, the entire periodic table. The amount of information that's going to come from this, the exciting conclusions that might come out in the next couple of years, is something that I hope has whet your appetite. And at that point, I think I will stop, and we move from the real global scale that John was talking about. I've tried to summarize some of the activities of the USGS. The next speaker will hone in on rare earth elements themselves, because I know that's a matter of great interest to people in the room. So thank you.
Let me introduce our final speaker. But minerals are a leading indicator of the U.S. economy. And Larry showed some products in terms of the commodity summaries and so forth. But the USGS is the sole source of comprehensive production consumption data for 90 mineral commodities in 180 nations around the world. And I think that includes just about all of them except what I would consider the usual suspects or absentees. So sharing with you just a little story, a number of years ago, there was a colleague when I was with USGS who was director of the German survey. And I remember talking to him on a couple of occasions about the commodity summary for Germany, in particular one commodity. And the Germans are pretty good record keepers. And there was a discrepancy between the German figures and the U.S. figures. And it drove this man crazy. And I remember not seeing him for about a year or so, and he came up to me and he says, "You're right. We're wrong." So I think that speaks volumes to the quality of the work that's done. And I think it was hard for him to say that. But again, it shows how valuable it is. Now, that's an interesting story, but there are users here at home that are particularly important that look at this information. Groups like the World Bank, the Federal Reserve, Department of Defense in terms of security aspects, other federal agencies, and certainly the financial and investment world really want to keep their pulse on these things. And let's not forget industry. You know, they're always looking for a competitive advantage, and knowing supply and demand and so forth really are important in terms of their day-to-day operation of their businesses. So what I'd like to do now is introduce our final speaker, and that's Joe Gambogi. Joe is a commodity specialist for rare earth elements at the USGS. And for more than 20 years, he has studied supply and demand for materials, including hafnium, silicon, titanium, and zirconium, Joe is currently responsible for preparing the USGS reviews on rare earths and thorium. So Joe will zero in on a specific element of interest today. So, Joe.
Thank you, Pat. All right. See how this goes. Okay, like Pat said, I'm going to zero in on rare earths. And I do come from the USGS National Minerals Information Center. So, rare earths, what are they? They are, if you recognize the periodic table, at the very bottom is the lanthanide series. Everything from lanthanum to lutetium. And added to that, we're going to talk about yttrium and scandium. Together, people talk about them as the rare earths. Another term that you hear if you follow rare earths is, rather than talk about everyone individually, people talk about them as light rare earths and heavy rare earths. The light rare earths in terms of atomic number, 57 to 64 and 65 to 71. There is debate. People will move that line up and down depending on their own interests. So, but what are they good for? We know they do all these high-tech stuff for defense and energy, but 75% of the rare earths are used in the top four applications. For catalytic applications, a lot of material goes into oil refining and in automotive catalysts and making plastic. In terms of metallurgical applications, rare earths are added to other alloys to improve their properties. And this is particularly interesting for battery alloys. And so it has been anyway, for the metal hydride batteries that go into things like power tools and electronic devices. And I believe all the hybrid cars are using the nickel metal hydride batteries. So what's next? Polishing. Everybody has a cell phone in their pocket. That smooth surface that the glass has, that's from rare earths. Okay, so the remaining 25% in the other category. Although it's a lesser volume, you'll notice that a lot of people are paying attention. May or may not be. You see the symbols that are associated with heavy rare earths. And these are particularly important for defense and energy. Things like fiber optics and laser targeting for defense. For phosphorus, all the compact fluorescent bulbs that everyone's putting in their house, they have rare earths. So, where are they? Well, actually, they're all over the globe. This is an occurrence map. Occurrences and deposits of rare earths. And you can see they're distributed all over the globe. But what this map doesn't tell you is all the hurdles that you have to go through to bring an occurrence to a mine. So the mine map is going to look a lot different than the occurrence map. And here we have. These are the active locales for mine production. And let me explain it a little bit. So I have this bar chart across the bottom that goes from the light rare earths to the heavy rare earths. And you can see that most of the pie charts that are next to the locales are pretty green. So in terms of availability of material, you see that the light rare earths dominate the supply. And really, there is a little of a deposit in Malaysia that is heavy rare earths, but you don't really. There's not a lot of volume there that comes out. So, for the large part, we rely on China, southern China, for the heavy rare earths. Okay, moving along. In terms of supply and demand, you can see from 2009 to 2013, the global supply has gone down. Primarily in 2009 and 2010, because China has moved to restrict the supply of rare earths. And they've done that through a number of ways. One way is through production quotas. So they've been trying to reduce their amount the amount of rare earths coming out of China. What's happened over the past few years is the line is flattened, and that's in part due to new production from Australia and the United States. So, getting back to China, which we have to talk about when we talk about rare earths. In 2010, China announced that it would cut its production quota by 70% for the latter half of that year. Shortly after that, there were reports of a disruption of shipments of rare earths to Japan. So the quota was reduced significantly in 2010, but has leveled since then. I just saw something this morning where they're planning on reducing the quota again. In terms of production, this is the production quota. Interestingly, the production has exceeded the quota in all the years on this graph. But in 2009, it was something like 43,000 tons. And then by 2013, our estimated actual production was only about 6,000 tons greater than the quota. So those graphs are emerging. So this is basically what has happened to the prices of rare earths. Like, you can't really plot all the prices of rare earths because they're just not available, but I plotted what I could. So you can see what happened in 2010 to 2011. There's a significant price spike, and since then prices have come down. But if you look closely, kind of I see on the lighter errors, that the prices are still significantly higher than they've been historically. So, turning to imports. Imports into the U.S. Dropped significantly in 2011 and 2012. And this is a number of factors. Prices were higher, so people tried to live off their inventories. And there's new production from the United States. And there's probably a little softening in demand. The interesting thing is in 2013, imports have increased significantly, at least from what we know so far, because the trade data is always a couple months behind, so you never, today, I only know what happened 2 months ago. So they are significant, and this is confirmed through Chinese export statistics as well. What this chart doesn't tell you is the imports of the individual rare earths. Now, there's been some changes in July. If you look on your database, you'll see some improvement in the import statistics in terms of maybe yttrium and neodymium. So we'll have a little bit better picture of what's coming in. But you can see from these categories, it's hard to tell, well, which rare earths are we really dependent on? And finally, to sum up, U.S. production, or world production, is heavily reliant on China, but there's a number of mines coming on stream, so we should see more and more production outside of China. Numerous productions are out there. If you sign up for a news feed in rare earths, every day you'll get a new announcement of somebody increasing their mineral resource or a preliminary economic assessment or something like that. But as I said previously, there's a lot of hurdles to go into production. Prices have decreased significantly, but again, still higher than historic levels. And imports are increasing in 2013. And finally, the price peak in 2011 caused a lot of consumers, and I would say the government as well, to look into more closely recycling and conserving of materials. And I think the previous graph showed you that there is recycling of rare earths and conservation, but to be honest, it's mostly at this point in the light rare earths, in lanthanum and cerium, but they're also looking at recycling phosphorus and magnets as well. Finally, I'd like to say thank you for your attention, and that in order to get the kind of data that we do, it takes a collaborative effort between industry and government and the state agencies as well. Thank you again.
how about a round of applause for him? And I'd like the speakers to kind of come up here for question and answers. And as they're coming up, I want to thank our sponsor again, Congressman Rush Holt, and also our host organizations for this briefing, as well as the House Science, Space, and Technology Committee for letting us use their room here. There are some refreshments over here, so please avail yourself of that opportunity at the end of the briefing. But I'd like to open the floor to questions from the audience to any of our speakers. How about right here?
I had a lot of questions, but the one I'm going to ask is, there was a nifty device there for doing low-cost assay of ore. Is that capable of giving you a percentage of the minerals, of the metal content of each one that you find? And is it really cost effective?
I think it's the hydrogen. No, he's referring to it. So the analytical technique is using something called LA-ICE-BMS, which stands for laser ablation, inductively coupled mass spectrometry. And some people in the room will know the details of that. I won't go into it. Usually that technique is used for analyzing very, very small samples, much less than a gram. So the technique that we pioneered was being able to analyze much larger samples, because when you're dealing with something like a tailings pile, you've got a large sample, and analyzing a tiny little speck just doesn't get the job done. So what we pioneered was the ability to analyze larger samples using this. There's a publication, a technical publication, describing exactly how that's done. And then that results by running that vaporized sample that's done by the laser through the mass spec in the entire periodic table down to very low levels of detection. So yes, they're all reported, and you can talk about percentages. Most of the elements would be much less than a percent level, but whatever it is would get reported, and you can sum all those up to the total. And in terms of its cost effectiveness, it's something that we're doing this on a developing a new technique basis. We can't really talk about the cost, but this is the main analytical technique that all the analytical labs in the world do for analyzing geochemical samples and mining samples, and so there's no reason why it shouldn't be able to be available to people.
Second row here.
Oh, yes, I have a question for John. Could you estimate about how much of that Nevada gold is on public land?
I'm not exactly sure. Probably close to half, but there's a good chunk of it that's within the railroad lands. That's a checkerboard that cuts up along Interstate 80, the old rail, the Transcontinental Railroad. And a fair amount of the deposits are in that checkerboard area where it is indeed 50-50. Most of the rest of Nevada is managed by the feds. So 50%, maybe a little bit less than that is, maybe a little less is private. I guess a little more than 50% is on federal.
In the corner here.
Yeah. Who are the three major, say, if you look at two, three major corporations that are producing critical or rare materials in the United States? Who would they be competitively, and how much government support would they receive, or do they receive to produce it?
I think, in order for me to answer, I'm the rare earth person. But you would have to ask that question in terms of what particular metal. You would really need to ask that in terms of what particular metal. Usually what happens if, I know I'm not answering the question, but I am on the hill. What usually you can do is go to the Minerals Yearbook. And in the Minerals Yearbook, they'll talk about the top producers in the U.S. And that's, having a non-answer, that's the closest I can come. Or I can try and get you an answer.
But was the question rare earths?
It's not specifically rare earths. I mean,
for example, Molycorp.
Molycorp is the only U.S. producer.
Not just rare earths, though, of other critical materials.
Yes, they do. I think they do rhenium as well, in terms of metal. They do a host of metals.
Yeah, Molycorp is primarily a rare earth producer. Kennecott is the big producer of rhenium as a byproduct of their copper operation in Utah. And it all depends on the individual element. There is a big lithium producer in Nevada. It's the only current lithium producer in the U.S. And it all depends on the metal. But probably one of the issues in that is that it is a limited number of companies that are producing many of these what we consider critical elements. There's one significant platinum and palladium producer in the U.S. today. So it is a limited number of companies for each of those main critical elements.
Well, okay, how much support, for example, would Molycorp receive from the government, or does it receive?
I'm not aware that they're getting any financial support for their operations.
Kathy, I think you had your hand.
I was just going to say that government doesn't fund mineral exploration or development in the U.S. There's no contributions. And in fact, some people might argue that they, because of the delays in permitting, that they add a lot of cost to the actual process of trying to bring something online. It averages 7 to 10 years to get permit in the U.S. or longer.
Well, previously, during the war effort, they used to contribute to exploration, for example, for molybdenum.
They don't.
Yeah.
Canada has some significant programs that stimulate exploration, but the U.S. hasn't had anything like that.
How about the back row here?
Yes. If you can comment, to what degree does the processing technology and the separation technology play a critical role here? And is the government looking at that area and trying to help accelerate any processing technologies?
Would you like me to take that? I'll try. Okay.
Yeah, I assume we're talking about rare earth elements.
I was. Okay.
And it plays a huge role. The recovery of rare earth elements from the minerals that are present in the deposit is a very complicated matter, and it varies from deposit to deposit of what minerals are present and what processes you use to separate them. There is active government research, mainly spearheaded by the Department of Energy in what they call their Critical Minerals Hub in Ames, Iowa, that is looking at various aspects of how these things are processed. I don't know the details of that, but that would be one place to go for information.
How about right here?
How would increasing the strategic rare earth element reserve impact consumer products that are using rare earth elements?
Increasing the stockpile?
Yeah.
Well, I think the stockpile is mainly geared towards defense applications in times of emergency.
Right, but how would increasing that, would it at all impact?
I think probably by design, it is not. There's a market impact committee that looks at something like that. That you don't want to be harming your everyday purchases or normal consumption. So you don't want to be disrupting the market when you go out and buy or stockpile rare earth metals. And generally they don't make big purchases. Even if there was a big purchase, they would probably space it out over time.
How about over here?
Yeah, John, so earlier you posed a question, will the U.S. be a major producer? And you said we need to be. So I was just wondering, what are some potential hindrances or real ones to that becoming a real effect?
Well, as Kathy mentioned earlier, a big hurdle right now is the time that it takes to bring a property into production. I mentioned that we're not likely to run out of mineral resources globally, and probably not in the United States because we have such a varied geology within the country. But the ability to bring something online quickly is a huge issue. For us to ramp up our rare earth production quickly, should China decide to cut off its exports of either raw rare earth materials or the manufactured magnets that go into wind turbines or the heavies that go into some of the defense applications, for us to ramp up quickly would be almost impossible with today's regulatory climate. But there are ways that could be dealt with. I don't think anybody wants to minimize the environmental issues. The companies these days are quite concerned about environmental impacts, but the speed at getting things permitted, the speed of starting things up is huge. In that study that we did of the energy critical elements with the American Physical Society and Mineral Materials Research Society, we also realized that there's a huge time lag for developmental and production side for manufacturing. So in addition to the lag in bringing a ore deposit into production, there's also on the order of a 10-year time frame to bring a new technology into place. So if we come up with a good substitute for some of the rare earths in certain applications, it's going to take another 10 years to bring those substitutes into a full-scale production as well. So the time lag in the U.S. for getting things accomplished is to me one of the big issues.
And is that an issue of federal regulation taking its time?
Primarily.
I think in the interest of time, people schedule, it's just 12 o'clock on the dot. The speakers will be here. Refreshments are available. And again, I want to thank the speakers and thank you for your time. So.